Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum. Mary joins us pretty often during tax season to answer your questions. She has 30 years of experience as a tax professional, 21 years experience teaching tax programs to other professionals, and she and her husband operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. So if you have some questions about taxes, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Mary, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us once again.
You're welcome, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Oh, a busy time for you?
Yes, it is.
April 18th this year.
Yes. Technically, that's the last day.
Yeah. What should we be? Are there anything, is there anything right now that we should be doing to help us on next year's taxes?
Start record keeping early.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. I think for people who are unsatisfied where they are this year, for instance, they owe a lot more in for the 2015 tax than they did or than they want to. Right now, they need to look at their withholding or their estimated tax payments so the same thing doesn't happen next year. So I think that would be review the withholding, because now's the time to change it to get in a better spot for next year's filing.
Yeah, that's good advice. I filed my taxes and have already gotten my refunds back, which were not large, which is probably okay. But at least I didn't have to pay anything in.
And it seems that most people don't want to pay in.
Yeah.
Some people are of the philosophy that the government should not use their money, and so they want it to be as tight as possible, but they rarely like to write that check. And for some people, they really like having that money come back to them at tax time. And right now, with interest rates not so high,
yeah,
that's not even a bad thing. It's a comfort level.
Yeah, it's kind of a forced savings, I think people look at it.
And it's whatever works for that person, their comfort level. But now's the time to make the positive or negative changes so that it affects more of the year than waiting till the middle or the end of the year to hope to bring it back where you want it to be.
Yeah, that makes good sense. For those who haven't filed yet and were in that process, any regulations or new rules that we should be aware of that might affect this year's or next?
Things are pretty much the same as they've been. There were extended programs, things that may not have been extended that were extended for this year. So it's pretty much the same rules that there have been in the past. For those who have not filed yet, it may be their typical time. It may be they're dragging their feet. It may be they've been waiting for those late brokerage statements. Whatever the reason that they haven't filed, there are still a couple of things that they may be able to do if they're getting unsatisfactory results.
Okay.
And the two things that I can think of for federal tax purposes would be to contribute to a traditional IRA or to contribute to an HSA if you are in an HSA-qualified insurance plan. Those are the two things that, after the fact, I can do something about.
That makes good sense. Patricia in Madison has a question for you, so let's go to her. Patricia, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I receive a dividend check from a company in which I have shares, and it's issued through a bank who handles all their financial things. And the bank assesses a fee every time that dividend check is issued. And I called the company and tried to find out, is there any way I can deduct this, that they're assessing this fee? And they said, no, that we don't provide for that. So what can I do? I know I looked up under other miscellaneous deductions, and there's something in regard to a 2% limit of one's adjusted gross income, and I don't know if this is 2% beneath it or 2% above it.
Mm.
What you're talking about is the deduction for investment expenses. If you have expenses incurred in making investments, then those deductions are allowed on the Schedule A, so you must itemize first.
Right.
And you must meet the 2% of adjusted gross income. So it's 2% of the bottom number on the front page of the 1040 form.
Right, but is that 2% of it under it that
No.
Over.
You put together all of your miscellaneous expenses.
Yes.
Subtract out 2% of your adjusted gross income, and you get anything over it.
Oh, that's what I figured, yeah.
It works the same way that the medical deduction does, except that's 7.5% or 10%, depending on your age.
I interpreted the correct way, but it's not to my benefit.
Yeah. How often does that happen? Pretty often, I'm unfortunately. Patricia, I'm glad we were able to help you out there. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Vivian in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Vivian.
Well, good morning. I'm right in the backyard for Mary's business, and I can tell you her reputation here is outstanding, and I've had the pleasure of working with her just on a single situation. But as usual, Larry, your guests are just top-notch.
Thank you.
Okay, two questions. I called thinking I'd have only one, but your conversation about forced savings and getting back as much as possible. If we minimize withholding, is that a protection against some of those fraudulent Social Security claims? I mean, if I let the government hold $4,000 as a forced savings and someone does a false application under my name, are they going to get that $4,000?
I guess I'm not sure where you're going with that. As far as Social Security earnings, are you talking about?
Well, no, I'm talking about the withholding to the IRS. And then we have someone who claims in our name that, you know, they want a refund.
Okay.
And I'm thinking,
and you're thinking of a fraudulent return.
Yeah, and somebody else taking that money.
Can we protect ourselves?
Yeah.
Generally, with the fraudulent returns, they create a whole series of numbers and file the return based on those numbers, and there isn't any cross-checking at that point.
Okay.
And getting that number back. So I wouldn't say that that's going to necessarily give them, for instance, I say I only had 2,000 withholding and the real person had 4, would it give them the extra? I don't believe that that's going to be the case, especially in this time of watching for fraudulent returns.
Okay.
So I wouldn't think that to be a problem.
Then back to the reason I called. My sister is 82. She's single. She started taking Social Security at age 70. She spent her life working in factories and McDonald's and doing cleaning. She now cleans every other weekend for a few hours. And when I did her income tax, I noticed that they're still deducting on her W-2 for Social Security tax and Medicare tax. And I wondered if there was no limit to when those...
As long as you work, you will pay Social Security if you work in a job that requires Social Security withholding. It doesn't make any difference how old you are or how young you are. If there are no exceptions, and there isn't an exception for age, they will continue to deduct it.
And do you know if she doesn't get any benefit from those tax deductions? Is that something that could be deducted as a cost of earning wages?
No, it is not. Okay. The two are totally separate.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Vivian, very much for calling. And just to follow up on what Vivian was talking about, in terms of sort of protecting yourself against this false, somebody else, you know, getting your tax return, I believe you said last time that a good thing to do if you can is to file as early as possible every year.
Well, filing as early as possible beats the other person to the draw, so to speak.
Yeah.
But in many cases, especially the people that have not filed yet, that's not a possibility. For anyone that is waiting on brokerage or investment information,
no.
There's no way that they're going to have the necessary papers to file early.
Yeah.
You know, watch things, protect yourself, protect your Social Security number. That's how the basis is right now. IRS has put in place some programs with W-2s and things as pilot programs to enter codes to make sure that you are really that person. And so they are trying.
Oh, that's wonderful.
To work it out. But, you know, there is always where there's a criminal, there will be a crime.
Yeah, unfortunately. I'm sure they're already, the criminals are already working, anticipating and working on getting around that.
That's true.
Tom and Shano up next. Hi, Tom.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What have you got for us today?
I'd like to know what you have to do. I sold a house for $300,000, our residence, and we're not going to reinvest that money in another house. What kind of taxes do I have to worry about paying?
Well, Tom, the good news is that the law has changed since the law that your good memory remembers. And I suspect that you've been in this house for some time?
Well, no, actually, we only moved here about 5 years ago.
Okay. The law says now that if you have owned and occupied a principal residence for 2 out of the last 5 years, and your gain is not more than, and that's the gain, not more than $250,000 per person, spouse having $500,000, and you have not used this property for business, you probably will not pay any taxes on that gain.
Does it have to be reported on the income tax then at all?
For safety's sake, I like to tell my clients that we report it. The reason I do is because I'm never sure if a 1099 or 1099S is issued, that's the sale of property, is issued in their name. When you go to the broker to sell your house, there is a statement that you can sign that says, I've not used this for business, I've lived in it 2 out of the last 5 years, owned and occupied, and my gain is not more than $250,000. And that is supposed to be relieve the broker of having to send the 1099-S to the government. But we're never sure if that's the case. So as a safety valve, we do report it.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom. Good news for you. Mike in Elk Mound, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
I have sold some property, and it'll be a capital gain for 2016. And I understand the capital gains will not be taxed by the federal if I'm under the 25% tax bracket, but it will be taxable in Wisconsin. And my question is, do I need to pay some sort of estimated tax to Wisconsin to avoid some penalties when I pay my taxes next year?
Is this long-term capital gain property?
Yes, it was some property that I inherited from my parents.
Okay. In Wisconsin, as you mentioned, the rule is different than the rule in federal.
Mm-hmm.
If it is long-term capital gain property, Wisconsin taxes 70% of the gain. And so if you calculate 70% of that times the tax rate, and I use somewhere between 6 and 7% just as a safety valve, that would be a good amount to send in as an estimated tax payment to the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin also has a higher penalty rate than the federal government. They charge 12% interest if you do not pay enough money, and $500 is the magic number at the end of the day. So it's important to send that money in to save yourself some extra cash.
Okay, so you do have to pay estimated on capital gains?
Yes.
And,
if you owe the state of Wisconsin more than $500 when you file your tax return and you did not pay more than last year's taxes, there will be a penalty. And it's currently 12%.
Okay. And so I should withhold, what, 7%?
I would be on the safe side and go with 7% of 70% of the gain.
Oh, okay. 7% of 70% of the gain.
Yeah, so if it was 100,000 gain, you'd have 70,000 gain, and you'd take 7% of 70,000.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Mary Mellum, 30 years experience as a tax professional. She and her husband operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and, of course, dealing with your taxes. So give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org. Post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And we have Chuck and Shatek up next with a question. Hi, Chuck. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good show. Your guest mentioned that as long as you work, you're going to pay into the Social Security system. I was not aware of that because I spoke to Social Security. I'm on Social Security. I spoke to them before I took a short-term job that I was offered that I couldn't pass up. And they indicated if I made over a certain amount, I'd pay back some of my Social Security, and that wasn't going to take effect, and this, that, and the other. So then I sit down and do my taxes, and, of course, I have to pay my 15.3% because I was considered self-employed, which I found was interesting because my taxable income, as it worked out, ended up to be zero after my standard deduction and exemptions and that. And then I ended up having to pay that 15.3% on it. Now, I had a friend who has rental properties, who's older than I am, and they pay no Social Security tax on their rental income.
Hmm.
I looked that up, and that's a fact. They pay no Social Security tax on rental income.
Oh, and you're kind of breaking up, Chuck. I'm sorry, actually. Mary, a comment?
Sure. What he's talking about, for one thing, is self-employment tax. The 15.3 is the rate for self-employment tax. And again, it doesn't matter whether you're a young child that's mowing lawns or if you're receiving Social Security benefits. If you are self-employed, you will pay that, even if your tax rate is zero. Rental property is not considered self-employment. It's considered income for the It is an activity for the production of income, which is not subject to self-employment tax. So there's a difference between the two activities.
Gotcha.
And that's the difference. The other thing that the caller mentioned was about paying back money to Social Security. There's kind of a conflict that some people don't understand. If you are under age 65 and drawing Social Security and working, if you earn too much income, you will pay back some of the Social Security benefits. That's a completely different concept or topic from paying Social Security tax on the earnings.
Gotcha. Makes sense. David emailed to say he is renting to a family member at less than the going rate. Wants to know how he should report rental income and expenses.
Renting to a family member says that you don't get deductions that drive that rental income below zero. And so you're able to take deductions up to the point of the rental income, but never create a loss. For most people, that's going to be their property taxes and their mortgage interest. And IRS has created a hierarchy of expenses, And the first one are the things that you would get a deduction for anyway, which would be your property taxes and your mortgage interest. And you will get the property taxes regardless of whether it eats up all of the rental income you're collecting. If there is rental income after you do the property taxes and the mortgage interest, the next set is your normal operating expenses. And then lastly, depreciation would fall into the category, and for many people, they never get that far. It could be a Schedule E at zero, or if it is a not-for-profit rental, the income goes on page one on line 21. The expenses go on that 2% line that we talked about earlier on Schedule A.
Yeah. Here's a little version of what we were talking about earlier as well. Paul writes this, you know, he understands the proceeds from the sale of the house are non-taxable up to, what is it, $250,000 if owner-occupied. But how is that affected if he rented out rooms while he lived there and he reported the income on his taxes?
If you have used that property for business, and I use that term lightly, rental in this case, we're talking about business, not self-employment, but business anyway, he has probably taken depreciation. And if he has taken depreciation on his home and the property is within the home, not a different structure, he will have to pay taxes on the gain equal to the depreciation that he's taken.
Ah, there we go. Michael in Madison has something for us. Hi, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. And thank you, Mary, for this wonderful service. This question kind of dovetails with the self-employment question before. I just very recently started writing, just very, very, doing a very small self-employment job. It brings in about $100 a month. Very small. I had to go get, a federal tax ID for it, something I've never had to do before. And in my normal life, I file married filing jointly with my wife, and, we just kind of have regular incomes for our day job. So my question is about this, $1,200 a year or something like that that's coming in under this, what seems to me to be a separate tax identity that I got the federal tax ID for. One caveat is I give all that money away to a qualified charity. My net income from that is nothing. I just give it away. I think I know the answer to this, but do I have any tax responsibility in terms of filing or paying out of that freelance job that I do?
The answer is yes. Yes, you do. The law says that if you receive any income, it's taxable unless we tell you differently. That's kind of the basis for it. I'm a little confused about the tax ID number. Do you have employees?
No.
Did you organize it? Did you incorporate and make it a corporation? Normally,
I should have an answer for you. I just know they told me I had to get a separate federal tax ID number.
And are you? Did you form an LLC?
No.
Okay.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I mean, it was very fast. I just went to the IRS website. It took like a minute and a half, and they generated a number for me.
If you have a federal ID number, generally that means that you're an entity, except that every business who has employees has to have a federal ID number. To file the payroll reports. But that being aside, if you have not told the government that I'm a partnership, S corporation, a C corporation, you're a Schedule C person, and this is incorporated into your tax return. And so you would report the $1,200 of income, report any expenses against it, and reduce by those expenses. That bottom line is what's subject to Social Security. If you give all of the money away, that would be a Schedule A charitable deduction, and it may wash, but the two don't wash.
Yeah.
The gift
of
it would not reduce your self-employment tax.
So, I wouldn't think so. So the Schedule C, that could be part of our regular tax return.
That is correct.
Oh, that's great. Okay, that's great news. And then we would just, we give away other charitable.
Sure. You would incorporate
that in itemized.
What you have given away as part of your itemized deductions. Exactly.
Yep.
Excellent. That's great news. Thank you so much, Mary.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. We have, let's go to Dina in Cedarburg next with a question. Hi, Dina.
Hi, Larry, Mary. Great information today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am a self-employed bookkeeper, so I really love today's topic, but I don't do a lot with taxes, so I'm wondering, I take an expense for a home office expense against my house, and wondering how that would affect the sale of my home in the future.
That's also a good question, and much like the last response, when you have a home office, you're also entitled to depreciation on that portion of your home.
Okay.
To the extent that you have taken and used that depreciation, you're going to pay taxes on the sale of your home when you sell it.
Okay.
Even if everything else is excludable, the exclusion goes up to the point of how much depreciation you have benefited from in the past.
But okay, if you haven't depreciated...
Well, depreciation is allowed or allowable. So if you have office and home, the only reason it wouldn't have been allowed is if you couldn't take it because you didn't have enough income. Office and home can never drive Schedule C profit below zero.
Right. And so I'm wondering, I don't know. I guess I'll have to look back at all my returns now.
Yeah. You would look back to see. One of the things you can tell as you look at the office and home form, if you have a carryover depreciation in the year that you sell the house, look for the carryover depreciation because that's telling you that much of it you haven't benefited from.
Got it. Okay, wonderful. Gives me some fun stuff to look over tonight.
Thanks, Dina. Appreciate the call. All right, let's go to Charlie in Madison next. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. I am a full-time grad student, and I had no income for 2015. However, I did have an internship with a state agency with the state of Wisconsin, from which I received $2,950. And I guess I'm just not exactly sure how to treat that when I file, or I'm sure I need to like still file, but I'm not exactly sure I guess what to do because I didn't receive a W-2 or any kind of formal paperwork, I guess, with it.
All right. I'm surprised that if you were involved in an internship, why you didn't receive a tax document. I think I would go back to the agency and say, am I considered a contractor, in which case you may not have received the document, although a 1099 would be surprising that you didn't receive that. But if that's your only income for the year and it's not as a self-employed person, then you have no tax requirement to file.
Oh, okay. So I don't even need to file then this year?
If you only had $2,950 and it is not contract labor, i.e. self-employment tax, there is no need to file. But again, I would go back to them and ask them, why don't I have a tax document of one kind or another? And it would be either a W-2 or a 1099 miscellaneous that you'd be normally expecting.
Sometimes internships are turn into a scholarship kind of situations.
And that's possible. If that money was used to reduce your tuition.
I was told that it's essentially a stipend, and for tax purposes, essentially, we weren't given very much guidance on it. But it's a program through the University of Wisconsin, so
it'll be easy enough to check, Charlie.
I say
it would be easy enough to check. You would go to the administrative person in the department where you worked.
Okay.
And I think you get a pretty quick answer from him or her. Yeah. At least that's what I do, since I think I've had those kinds of situations, something sort of similar to that in my own department. So, Wallace and Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Wallace.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a World War II veteran, 93 years old, and the VA has officially declared me blind. So I have to hire somebody to take my automobile to make trip to the Twin Cities, which is 108 miles each way.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, they have made arrangements that I can get some treatments here, a considerably less mileage. I've been keeping track of the mileage. Can I claim deductions, reimbursement for this mileage?
If your mileage is for medical purposes, the answer is yes.
Well, okay, I appreciate you.
Yeah.
That information. I kind of thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure.
Yep.
So, okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Wallace. Appreciate the call. We have some open lines. Not many, but a few. You can get on as we visit with Mary Mellon. Doesn't she do a wonderful job? Mary Mellon, 30 years experience. She and her husband operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And the number to call for you to join in, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. That's the title of the page. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. Chris in Shawano has a question. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning. I had to look at the clock. Sorry.
Yeah.
I got a question. We've been looking into a contracted driver position. So it'd be a 1099 contracted driver, and the payment is made per mile. Now, that's a loaded, when your vehicle is loaded with a passenger or what have you. So can I deduct mileage, the federal mileage rate, for a loaded and unloaded trip? So say when I leave my driveway, complete the day, come home, is all that mileage?
What type of vehicle are you driving?
It's a personal vehicle, basically.
Okay. It's not an 18-wheeler or a steak truck or something of that nature. It's
no,
an automobile.
A regular automobile.
Okay. If yes, as if you are paid per mile, that's just telling what your gross income is, and against that gross income, you're able to take deductions to do that job. If you are a contract person, generally your home base is where you're starting. And wherever you drive to from there, if you keep the proper records, you can use the standard mileage rate to go
okay.
from there.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Just wanted to verify. And then you can also do the home office deduction because you're not commuting to an office, correct?
If you have a need for an office in your home to complete bookkeeping, record keeping, meet clients, those kinds of things, and it is a dedicated space, not used
okay.
for any other purpose, the answer is yes.
Okay. And any other deductions that would be available, such as auto insurance or interest on auto loans? I was doing some reading and
auto insurance, gas, and repairs are all incorporated into the standard mileage rate. If you have tolls or interest on a loan to purchase the vehicle, those are over and above if you're using the standard mileage rate.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris, for calling. Appreciate your call. Ann on Facebook said they've always done their own taxes. This year her husband's working from a home office. Should she have taxes prepared professionally to get the home office deduction? Her biggest concern is the high-speed internet he needs. They had to bundle with landline, which is only for his office, and cable. They use the cable sometimes since they have it. Can they deduct some or all of the bundle cost?
The answer to the first question is, should she have professional help? I'm always an advocate of that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, me too.
To get the best knowledge and the most up-to-date things. As far as the bundling costs, if you have bundling costs between personal and business use, if you can come up with a reasonable expectation or a reasonable use of business versus personal, you're always allowed to deduct that. But you, again, have to figure out either by hours of use, by, you know, some type of method, what is reasonable for the business portion of it versus the home portion of it.
There we go. Let's go to Jim and Kiwani next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Wonderful show. Thank you so much. I got a question. I inherited some land from my parents, and I signed it over to my wife 25 years ago, and she's a caregiver. I'm disabled. What is she looking at? What kind of tax when she sells the land?
So we had some problems. So you have some property that you inherited, just so I've got this right, 25 years ago. You turned it over to your wife. She is the caretaker for you because you're disabled. And your question is, what kind of taxes will you have to pay when you sell the land?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Wisconsin is a community or a marital property state. And if you have things that it really doesn't matter so much how things are titled, unless sometimes in inheritance and gifting that can be separate. But when this property is sold, if you file a joint return, it's going to be on both persons' tax return. The important part is not the turning over of the property, but what is the basis or the cost in that property. If it was inherited 25 years ago, you have to look back to see what the property was worth when you inherited it 25 years ago, and that is your starting point to decide how much gain you have when you sell it.
Oh.
So records, the inventory from the person, the probate estate of the person who died, would likely be a good place to start looking for what that property was worth 25 years ago.
Yeah. So that's a good reason. I'm, you know, if you have some property like that, to get that, to have that information at the time.
IRS has put rules in place, or Congress has put rules in place now, that if the estate is very large, that requires an estate income tax, a 706, or an estate valuation tax, that the personal representative must give that information to the heirs. But everybody doesn't get involved with the $5 million estate.
Yeah.
For the rest of us, we have to search out that information.
Mary Mellum, our guest today, doing a wonderful job talking about your taxes and mine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here's a look at what's coming up this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from Seabiscuit, an American Legend by Laura Hillenbrand. Then join us from 1 till 3 for the Kathleen Dunn Show. After 1, a look at an uncertain future for college football. After 2, Kathleen is joined by legendary TV producer Norman Lear. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
Wisconsin Life is out in Wisconsin.
My name is Shelley Wollerman, and I am a certified arborist. The hardest part about learning to climb is to trust your system. I can almost guarantee you the tree will fail before your gear does. So you have to trust your rope.
Wisconsin Life. The people and places that sound like home. Mondays and Wednesdays during Central Time and online all the time at wisconsinlife.org.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin-based Country Travel Discoveries. This summer offering off-the-beaten-path tours of Iowa, North Dakota, Lake Superior, and other close-to-home destinations. More is at countrytraveldiscoveries.com. Support for WPR comes from MG&E, committed to building a community energy company for the future by reducing carbon emissions and providing more renewable resources. More is at mge.com/energy2030.
Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your taxes with Mary Mellum. Mary and her husband operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and she does just a wonderful job talking with us about all the various tax situations. It's always amazing to me how many little differences can pop up from one tax form to another, from one person's taxes to another, and she does a great job answering those questions. Jim and Ladysmith has one for you, Mary, so let's go to Jim. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay, I got an audit in 2010 by the IRS, and everything went fine with them. And then 6 years later, Wisconsin sends me a tax notice that I owe them $5,000. I called the Wisconsin people, the tax man, and they acknowledged that this was the first letter I got in 6 years. They want to have penalties on there of $2,500. Is there any way to get out of that?
Oh.
Well, first of all, let's go back to the start of the audit. Number one, whenever someone has a federal audit, if there are changes made to the tax return regarding that federal audit, you automatically should do a Wisconsin amended return. That way you prevent this from happening to begin with.
I see.
Now, generally, the IRS or the state of Wisconsin has 4 years from the due date of the return to audit that tax return. Why they've been out 6 years, I would be a little concerned with that. And I don't know if they gave you any indication about that. But if they are in their rights for auditing, they certainly can collect all of that. What I would make sure is that you owe that money to begin with. Because if
right.
you don't owe the money, there wouldn't be any return, you know, any penalties and interest due on it. So
right.
I think you need to, you know, there's more questions to be asked in this situation. Again, if they're within their time, they certainly can do it. And under general terms, IRS has 3 years to go back to a return. The state of Wisconsin has 4 years, so they've got that extra year that goes out there. When you get into the 6 years, it's something that we call gross understatement. And if you have understated your income by 25%, then that opens a longer statute of limitations to 6 years. So I don't know if maybe that's something that's incorporated in this situation.
Hmm.
But I would suggest that you probably want to talk to a professional regarding this.
Would you talk to a tax professional, or would you talk to an attorney, or what would you do, Mary?
There are tax professionals and attorneys who do what we call representation work, and representation work means that they are in the business of dealing with IRS issues. Now, good tax professionals can do it, but some people, like specialists as doctors, do just that. And
yeah.
So you can look around. You certainly, if you call the tax person or an attorney, because just because you're an attorney doesn't mean you focus on tax issues.
Sure.
But when you call that person, you would want to ask them, do you represent people before the IRS? Is this your focus? Representation works. Enrolled agents, EA designation. If you're looking at tax professionals, someone with an EA, enrolled agents designation, generally is someone that does work with the IRS.
Or with the Wisconsin revenue.
Wisconsin as well, and with tax representation issues.
Hey, you guys, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't it be, why would you think that Wisconsin is not connected with the IRS as good as they are? Why would it take 6 years to do that? With the computers and all that, wouldn't it be like a quicker, they'd know it quicker?
Wisconsin has their time for doing things, and many times in that last extra year that they have, they pursue the issues that haven't been responded to. The federal government generally exchanges information when they audit a return and exchanges information with the state to say, hey, we've audited this return. But the state has, you know, their own set of things that they're looking at, and it may be a timing issue. The 6 years tells me that there's something else going on.
Yeah.
All right.
Good luck. Thank you so much, Jim, for calling. Appreciate your call, and good luck to you with that. Shirley in La Crosse has a question. Hi, Shirley.
Hello. I have kind of a far-out story.
Okay.
But I think the auditing people in Austin, Texas, for the IRS are scamming me. Oh. I received a notice back in November that I didn't claim a whole bunch of things on my 1040. So, of course, I pull out my 1040, and they're all on there.
What year did you, in this notice, there is always a year that they are looking at?
Oh. Okay. Tax year 2013.
Okay. And was that the return that you were comparing it to see that you had reported all of these things?
Of course.
Okay. If that is the case, my recommendation is that you respond to that notice.
Okay.
And
wait, I did.
Okay.
And now I save everything. I never do anything verbally. I always get a receipt from the post office of mailing.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I have been to the local IRS office twice, and they can't help me, and they can't even figure out what Texas is doing. And now I'm just fed up with it. But they keep sending me notices all the time. And each time it goes down, except the tax rate goes up on it. On the last one I got, they were charging me 48% tax on what they claimed I didn't pay, which, of course, I did pay.
Again, I wouldn't worry about the tax rate. You need to get to the heart of the problem.
Well, that's what I want to know. I want to know who I go to, because I'm at the deadline date on their stupid thing, and I don't want them to freeze my bank account.
Again, going to someone who does representation work is what you can do. Otherwise, give a call to the telephone number that is on that notice and tell them you need more time and ask them to give you an extension on the time on that date.
But they've replied to all my things. Every time it comes back, they've knocked off one item that they agreed was on my return.
Well,
and then the next time they knock off another item that was on my return.
I don't think that is a scam. They're responding to you. But it's, you know, a slow boat. That's kind of a strange thing. I would suggest that you see a professional that can take a look at it and look at the situation.
Yeah, I think Mary's sure right on that. You don't want to fool around too much. Your idea, Mary, your suggestion that Shirley go ahead and ask for an extension, that's pretty much normally they'll give an extension, right?
Usually if you call them and say, I have a date and there's a good reason why I can't get it, most often they work with the taxpayer.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. It's a tough situation. You just want to sometimes tear your hair out, situation like that.
Yes.
Andrea in Iowa has a question. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I do have a question. Thank you for offering this information today. I lived in Wisconsin in 2015, and I moved then to Iowa. And this will become a tax question, so bear with me. I was divorced in Wisconsin, and important language was missed in the original decree pertaining to tax deductions. And an addendum was done, and the addendum was done in 2012. I was audited for 2011 taxes, and there was a verbal agreement that, which became written in 2012, that each parent would claim one child as a dependent, and since they are twins, it would be even going forward until they're 18. So I've been following the decree to the letter of the law since then. I have learned since then that since 2011, my ex-husband has been claiming both children.
Oh.
And it's a high conflict situation. So I'm unable to get him to even acknowledge me. So here's my question. The only way to solve this is to go back to court. The money that I spend in getting a professional to get this portion cleared up, is that deductible in any way? Can the monies that I will be spending on an attorney be claimed?
The answer to that particular question is no. The legal fees are deductible to collect taxable income, and there is no taxable income that is being collected by you in going to seek out this. So your legal fees are not going to do anything for you there. With regard to a divorce, about the only thing that legal fees that I can think of would be if you go back and are forcing the collection of alimony. That would be something that's taxable income, that the legal fees for that, for you to seek it, would be deductible. One question I'd like to ask regarding what you've said in the past. Do any of those two children live with you physically?
That's a great question. Because I've been through this, I've been doing a lot of research. This is interesting. I wish I could. I hope every divorced person is listening. So in federal law supersedes state law. And so even if you have a decree that says, which I do, it says that each parent receives the children 50% of the time. When you actually break down the placement schedule based on the wording of the placement portion of the decree of the children, the dates move every year because of the wording of the placement agreement, which is, in hindsight, very bad.
Oh.
And...
And here we are in a situation where we have to take a break. We'll be back and we'll see what more we can do about this situation and others. Stay with us. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum. 30 years experience as a tax professional. She operates Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals with her husband. It's great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in. And numbers to call, 800-642-1234. Prior to our news break, Mary, we were talking with Andrea, who's divorced her husband, and she were to each claim one of their twin children as dependents, but the husband has been claiming them both.
One of the things I want to start with a disclosure, I'm not an attorney, so there are legal things with this that, you know, wording of the divorce decree and things like that, that I can't speak to. But from an IRS tax perspective, the divorce decree doesn't mean anything to the IRS. What the IRS looks at in claiming dependents is, who does that child live with or be with at night, because they use night as their guide, for more than half the year? Many of your divorce decrees will assign joint custody. And if you have 50-50 custody in a year that has 365 days, one person has more nights than the other person. And so it's very difficult to have 50-50. From an IRS perspective, they will look at who has the child more nights during the year, and they will side with that parent, regardless of what the divorce decree says. If the parent who is claiming that child does something contrary to the divorce decree, that's a civil issue that can go back to court and result in things other than tax. But from an IRS tax perspective, the law says where did that child live more, or which parent did that child live more nights with? And it's a tough conflict, but that's the way IRS law is, or tax law.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling, and good luck with your civil, because obviously this is going to be a civil thing, with your ex-husband. I'm sorry you're having those problems. But Mary, thank you so much. That's a very clear explanation, and I appreciate, as I always do, your explanations about tax situations. And I want to give Mike in Cushing a chance to join us next. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have an interesting thing. I was a trustee for my brother-in-law who passed away in 2014. He had $25,000 worth of savings bonds, which I had tried to distribute to beneficiaries, transferred to them before he died, but was able to. And so I was able to cash them out. The tax form to me under my Social Security number. So what I did with some guy, I got a 1056 form for 2015 and sent that in to distribute and sent the 1096s, the 99 interest form to the beneficiary. Now, in order for me not to take...
Oh, you know what? I am so sorry, Mike, but I'm just not able to follow your discussion. The phone line is just too bad to do it. I'm going to ask you, and Mary, were you following?
I do have some of his question, and I'll be happy to talk about what I hope is
okay.
His issue. I know that the phone line is broken up, but maybe we can kind of talk about this a little bit.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I think the situation that Mike seemed to be talking about is it was savings bonds, which savings bonds, when they're cashed in, have interest due on the savings bonds. Unless you've made a special election that I can talk about later, when the savings bond is cashed in, the person who is cashing it, the name on the bond, is responsible for the interest. What he's saying is that these bonds, for some reason, are in his name or his Social Security number, and the income really belongs to someone else. And so the forms that he's talked about are doing something called nominee interest. And what he's saying is, it's going to show up in my Social Security number. It's not my income. Therefore, I am going to nominee it from me to that other person, and they will pick it up on their tax return. For him, it's going to be the interest that came in his name minus the nominee'd interest to the other parties.
Okay.
And that is a legitimate thing if, in fact, they do not, the income doesn't belong to him. Now, hopefully, the reason the income is that way is because the institution only put his name when it was a group of names or the first Social Security number. There is just another issue with that I'd kind of like to go to.
Sure.
Sometimes a will say, I'm leaving everything, in this case we're going to pick on Mike, I'm going to leave everything to Mike, but, you know, I'd like Mike to be a nice guy and give it evenly to the other members of the family. If everything is left to Mike in the document, then it's Mike's. If Mike wants to share those things with the other people, that's great. Mike can share those, but the document says those are Mike's. In a situation like that, that would be Mike's income, not able to nominee. If Mike wants to be a nice guy and share what he has because he knows that's what the person really wanted, he still has to pay the taxes. And what he shares could be out of the goodness of his heart, and as long as it's not more than $14,000 per person, Mike can give that money away, and I would recommend that Mike take the share of taxes that go along with it out of the proceeds before he gives the money away. If that amount that he is giving away, not because the will told him to, but because he's being kind or trying to do with the intent, if that amount happens to be over $14,000 per person, he needs to do the gift tax return to show that gift.
There we go. We have Ann in Milwaukee wants to know what the maximum itemized deduction is for donated household items.
There is no maximum deduction for donated household items. You're able to take a deduction for whatever you donate. However, if there is a Form 8832, I believe, don't quote me on the number there, but there is a special form when your donations of property are in excess of $500. It's an 8283 form. And if you are giving household goods or any type of goods, specific category, and that donation is more than $5,000, you need to have an appraisal of those goods to have it stand up.
And if it's, isn't it over, if it's 500 or if it's less than $500, you don't have to have an itemization of it, let's say?
Not necessarily. You should always have an itemization of it in order to substantiate your deductions. IRS can challenge any type of deduction as being reasonable or not. But if it is over 500, you have to use the 8283 non-cash charitable contribution form.
Ah.
So records are important at any level.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hello, thank you. I purchased an expensive adjustable bed for medical reasons. Can you tell me, is that deductible?
If the doctor is recommending or the doctor is telling you to do it, medical equipment is a deductible expense. So if it is one that is specifically given under the doctor's care, like a wheelchair or, you know, some other medical equipment, yes, it would be a medical deduction.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Judy in Duluth, Minnesota, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question again about what happens if a fraudulent return is filed in your name. In order to kind of prevent any hassle with the IRS, my personal strategy is that I always adjust my W-2s so that I actually owe at the end of the year. But what does the IRS do when it gets a fraudulent return asking for a refund and then someone like me sends in their return with payment?
If the IRS, if they have some inkling that this is a fraudulent return, they may hold it up. But if someone gets your Social Security number, files the return, creates a refund, and gets the refund, when you file your return, IRS is going to say, hey, wait a minute, this Social Security number came in before, and they're going to electronically reject that return. You're going to have to file it by paper in order to get it into the IRS, and then they're going to look at the situation and figure out who it is. I guess part of the reason maybe for filing with a balance due is it's more likely that you're a legitimate person if you've got the balance due. So from that standpoint, I can see limiting your withholding. But there's going to be a process that's probably going to take somewhere near 6 months to sort it out, to find out who it is. And I don't know that the IRS has a real good way to get that money back if they have issued that refund to that person. Obviously, they are watching for patterns and watching for groups that are doing these kinds of things and trying to prevent that refund from going out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
all right.
I'm really glad to know that they do something when they see that, and I would get a notification so I would know that there's been some identity.
And IRS has been sending out some notices beforehand to people before they've even signed filed their return saying, we think your return has been compromised. You need to file a paper return. And, you know, I can only say that they are dedicating time and effort to this.
That is good to know. Judy, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Patty in Stone Lake has a question for us. Hi, Patty.
Hi, and thank you for the show.
Sure.
I have a small business, and I use PayPal to receive some of my sales income.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that, and I haven't transferred it into my bank account, is that money, that income reportable when it goes into PayPal or when I put it into my bank?
It's reportable when you have the right to get it.
Oh, okay.
So I would say when PayPal has the money and you can get it from some source, that's when it's reportable.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Susan in Portage County up next. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I'm just curious about how taxes are paid to which state when the primary residence is Wisconsin and the person is working out of state.
Okay, that's a very good question. If you are a resident of Wisconsin, Wisconsin taxes your worldwide income, just like federal does. The state that you are working in also has a right to taxes during that period of time that you're working for. Wisconsin will give you a credit for the taxes that you paid to the other state, not to exceed what they would have charged you in Wisconsin for that income. So you would not be double taxed on that income from a Wisconsin perspective, as long as you fill out the proper forms. The form is a Schedule OS to properly report the taxes that you paid to another state.
All right. Good. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have other callers online. Mark on Facebook got married last year, wondering how his taxes would be different from this year.
Hmm. Well, both if you got married last year and you're filing jointly, your incomes are combined.
Mm-hmm.
And the tax, there are two exemptions. And generally, if you're a higher income person, as opposed to outside of the 15% bracket, your tax bill is probably going to go up. If the person did not change their withholding from single to married, they're probably going to be okay that first year. If immediately after marriage they went and changed it to a married taxpayer, they may find themselves owing in where they didn't owe in before.
Yeah, good explanation. Pete in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I started pursuing a patent about 3 years ago, and I never claimed it. With attorney's fees, patent drawings, and all that, I've accumulated about $20,000 in investment into this. I am not a corporation. I'm not an LLC. I'm a person. How do I get claim this, if at all?
The cost of a patent is an asset that you own. All of the cost of getting that patent goes into what we call the cost basis of that patent, and it is amortized over, I believe a patent is about 13 years, and don't hold me to that, but I believe that it's either 13 or 15 years that you would write that off against once you're in a business.
Okay, well, it doesn't look like, I think I hit a roadblock on this, so it doesn't look like it's ever going to come to that. So
is it anything that you would be able to sell to anyone that you would have?
That has been attempted, and there's interest, but no offers. So I'm thinking I'm just going to chalk this up to a loss, and I'm in a lot deeper than I
The only other thing that I would look at is there is a rule that says that I'm able to take as a capital loss expenses that I have incurred in trying to go into a business. And so the best that I would see is that you have a potential for a capital loss on the money that has been paid for that.
Yeah, that's worth a look.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the advice.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pete, for calling. We have Scott in Madison with something for us. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
See, I got a question in regards to, I received last year an inheritance from my father's passing away, and it was like about $36,000. And so I went ahead and I put that into basically kind of like a money market thing just to hang on to it. I'm a small business owner, and what I actually did is I took like $20,000 and put that into.
Oh.
Can I deduct that?
We completely lost you. You put $20,000 into a new truck?
Yeah.
Gosh, we're having trouble with the phone lines today. So he bought $20,000, or spent $20,000 of a $30,000 or so inheritance on a new truck for his business.
If the truck is used in the business, the truck is a depreciable asset of the business, and there are rules for being able to write that off. Generally, $20,000 is probably too much to write off all at once. We have bonus depreciation that may let him write off half of it, depreciation that allows it over a five-year period. Presuming it's 100% business, those numbers, you know, would be that percentage of that $20,000. Depending on the size of the truck, maybe he could expense it, take 179 on all of it. He has options.
Oh, he does. We have Amanda is self-employed, wondering if there's a comprehensive list of possible or available deductions.
Well, it depends on what line of work her self-employment is. There are a lot of resources. IRS has some business resources. If she went to the IRS website and in the search box typed in the type of business, she may see some of the IRS documents out there. Some of them are from the audit perspective of what the IRS is looking for when they audit a certain business, but that would be a good place to look.
Excellent. And here we are. Boy, time has flown by, Mary.
Time passes when you're having fun, Larry.
Oh, you do such a marvelous job, and I bet you are busy, busy, busy this time of the year.
That we are.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today. And you got one last bit of advice in 30 seconds?
Keep good records.
Yeah.
Best advice I know of.
You are absolutely right. I learned that lesson a long time ago, and I'm really pretty scrupulous about that sort of thing. Mary, thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Larry.
Mary Mellum. Doesn't she do a wonderful job? She has 30 years of experience as a tax professional and has actually for 21 years has taught tax programs throughout the country to other tax professionals. And, so of course, she works out of the Green Bay area. She and her husband operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. So it's Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Mary Mellum. And reminder again, tax day is April 15th this year. It is April 18th. So that's because the 15th, it's falling on the weekend and all that sort of business. Just to take a look ahead, coming up in about a half an hour, Kathleen Dunn will be talking with her guest about defense spending. And then tomorrow, already Friday again, and I'll be talking with the Gourd Gal. The Gourd Gal comes by every so often to talk about gourds and all of their uses and some events that are coming up relating to gourds. Thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.